Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler. Today, we'll be talking with John W.I. Lee, author of the book, The First Black Archaeologist, A Life of John Wesley Gilbert. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Deidre. It's great to be here, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you for coming. I wonder if you could begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Okay. Well, I am a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. I am originally from Hawaii, but I have been here in Santa Barbara for 22 years. And my main field is actually ancient history. I usually write and publish about ancient Greece and Achaemenid Persia, which is the first empire of ancient Persia. And I became interested in Professor Gilbert's story really by chance, because I was looking for a side project to distract me from a very difficult slog through some secondary literature on ancient Persia. And I realized that Professor Gilbert and I had been students at the same school, which is the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. It's a research institution in Athens, Greece, that was founded in 1881.
Now, I thought this was interesting when you talked about Gilbert as a seven-year-old. You found a Freedman's Bank account. Tell us about that story and his teacher.
Oh, it really is a wonderful story. And I start the book with the story of a young boy going to the Augusta branch of the Freedman's Bank to open an account. And I was really, I was led to that material with the help of one of my colleagues, a 19th century U.S. historian who's done a lot of work with these documents. As I mentioned, my main field is ancient history. So I got a lot of help from colleagues who work in the modern world. And I became fascinated with this document because it had young John Wesley Gilbert's own handwriting on it. And I looked through all the records of the Freedman's Bank for Augusta, and I was able to find a pattern where young Gilbert's teacher, Miss Cecilia Chestnut, was taking her students apparently to the bank about once a week. Because bank accounts of students that were associated with her were being opened there about once a week. So I surmised that she took them down to the bank and helped them open their accounts. And then for Gilbert's own life story, these bank account registers list the names of relatives. And that was sort of my first clue into finding his family origins, because his account register listed not just his teacher, but it listed his mother's name and the names of his uncles. And I was able to take those names and work backwards into the times of slavery and find those names in slave owners' documents. And in that way, to trace Gilbert's family and his ancestors, actually all the way back to the 1820s, I was able to do that.
Now, in 1873, what happened with John Wesley Gilbert's account and other accounts?
So there was, and some listeners of your podcast may know this, there was a financial crisis in the United States, and the Freedman's Bank had been very successful, but it also had suffered from poor management and speculative investing. And as a result of that 1873 crisis, the bank eventually had to shut its doors. And by 1874, the depositors, most of them had lost all of their savings. And for Gilbert's, you know, for young Gilbert and his family, this was a really, I think, a very difficult blow, because they must have put their savings into this account. Many families did. And perhaps both of his mother and his stepfather had also deposited their earnings there, and they did not have a way to get that money back after the collapse of the bank.
Now, you talked about a slogan in the book, "We Are Rising." What did that mean?
Yes, the slogan "We Are Rising" appears in several different forms. The most famous, instance of this, is when General O.O. Howard, who was a leader of the Freedmen's Bureau and efforts to advance post-Civil War Black education in the South, visited a school in Atlanta, and he asked the young the children there, who were I guess elementary school, middle school students, "What shall I tell the children in the North about you?" And a young boy stood up and said, "Tell them we are rising," by which he meant we are rising into knowledge and into education. And this became a rallying cry for young and old, for men and women, for boys and girls, for all African Americans after the war who were seeking to gain an education. And into the 1890s, we find this term as a slogan. We find it in poetry and sermons and elsewhere.
Now, you had a story about a Black student who was shot in December of 1870. Why is this significant in telling the story of John Wesley Gilbert?
Oh, yes. It's a terrible story. The student was a student at a school in Augusta called the Augusta Institute, and it had been the Augusta Institute had been set up with the sponsorship of Northern Baptist, the American Baptist Home Mission Society, and the school had been fairly successful and had found a location right in the center of Augusta. It had support from some of the leading members of Augusta's population, both Black and white Baptists. But the assassination of this student, who his teacher called him a dear, devoted, inoffensive man, reflects, I think, the feeling of other Augustans that education, and especially the kind of higher education that Augusta Institute was offering, was not something that they wanted to see Black people having. And this, the killing of this student resulted in the temporary closure of the school, as the white professor had to flee town. And it wouldn't be until sometime later that a South Carolinian, a man named Joseph Thomas Robert, would be able to reopen the school and to continue educating African American students as preachers and as teachers.
Now, his life at Payne College. Tell us a little about his life there.
So, Payne College began as Payne Institute. It opened its doors in 1884, and it was and is a very unique institution in that from the beginning it was a cooperative, interracial venture of Black Methodists and white Methodists. And Gilbert came to the Payne Institute after he had attended Augusta Institute. I mentioned that school. Augusta Institute moved to Atlanta, where it eventually became, it's the ancestor essentially of Morehouse College. But Gilbert could not stay in Atlanta. So he came back to Augusta, and he had no real options for further education. So he recalled this time as a very dark time in the early 1880s, when he despaired of achieving a liberal education. And then Payne opened up, and he found a way. He found a way forward, and he was the first student of Payne Institute. He was one of the first seven graduates, which, by the way, there were more women in the seven. There were four women and three men in the first graduating class, which that itself made Paine unusual, that it was coeducational from the start. In 1888, he became the first Black professor at Paine, and he lived his career. Much of his career was focused on Paine, which became Paine College in 1903, and of course still exists today as Paine College. So his life and his work were deeply tied together with the life and the prosperity of this school.
Now, the day he received the scholarship, tell us about the process that he went through to receive the scholarship to go to Brown.
Oh, you may have to edit this part out because I, at the moment, I cannot remember the exact parts of it. But let me start again so you can, I'll get a little break. You can edit that hiccup out. In order to attend Brown University, John Wesley Gilbert needed funding. And funding was available in the form of scholarships through Brown. There were various scholarships that had been endowed. But he had to take entrance exams, which included classical languages, Greek and Latin, modern languages, French, and also other topics, including, I think, mathematics and English. And he did well enough on those entrance exams in the fall of 1886 that he was able to have a scholarship that paid his tuition for Brown University. We actually have in the Brown archives, I was able to find the receipts for some of the scholarship checks that he received, which is a very neat little detail. But as many students who get scholarships will know, that money wasn't enough to pay for everything. So he also worked. And he recalls later on that he did things as widespread as shoveling snow in the winter, because Brown University is in Providence, where there were some very big snowstorms while he was there. He tutored students, and he did the account books for a local barbershop in the city of Providence. So he did all sorts of things in order to make money to pay for his room and board. And his mother seems to have sent him some money from home. And his Paine Institute professor, a man named George Williams Walker, who was a white Methodist minister, and who with whom Gilbert worked closely for basically his entire life at Paine. Reverend Walker also sent a small amount of money to help John Wesley Gilbert get through Brown.
Now, when he decided to marry, do you see that as marrying into a middle class Black family, and what was the importance of that?
Yeah, Gilbert's relationship with his wife, Osceola Pleasant, or Ola Pleasant, is really fascinating because John Wesley Gilbert himself came from a background that was very, very obscure. It's very difficult to find information about, for example, his mother's life, except that Gilbert himself talked about being raised or nursed in the arms of poverty. But Ola Pleasant's family, on the other hand, was part of a higher socioeconomic status group of Black people in the city of Augusta. So members of her family owned property. Some of them were free before the Civil War. They had family resources in a way that Gilbert did not when he was growing up. So certainly Gilbert's marriage to Ola was for him a marrying up, but I also think it was a marriage of the minds, I guess, because she was also interested in education, and she studied at Fisk University in Nashville, and she also worked as a teacher. So I think they had their personal relationship, I think, was founded on their shared interest in teaching and education. And I even have found an instance where they went to a teacher's conference together, which I think is quite interesting.
Robert Rules of Order. Tell us about that in John Wesley Gilbert.
Yes, that is the story of Robert's Rules of Order is quite an interesting one. I mentioned that the Augusta Institute, which later became the ancestor of Morehouse College, was led by a South Carolinian, a white South Carolinian named Joseph Thomas Robert. Now, Robert had been a slave owner, but he was he developed very strong anti-slavery convictions. And as he entered the ministry, he freed his slaves, and he eventually moved his family north to Iowa because he didn't want his children to grow up where there was slavery. But much of his family fought for the Confederacy, and some of them were very strongly pro-Confederacy, including J.T. Roberts' own his own wife. But there was one exception, which was J.T. Roberts' son, Henry Martin Robert, who was a West Point graduate and who fought in the Union Army. And in the 1870s, H.M. Robert published a book of rules for parliamentary procedure and of guidelines for public speaking and public oratory. And that was the first edition of the book that we know today as Robert's Rules of Order. And H.M. Robert gave, it seems, maybe about 10% of the first print run of Robert's Rules of Order to his father. And his father used it as a book for students possibly in Augusta, but certainly in Atlanta. So to bring the story back to John Wesley Gilbert, that means that John Wesley Gilbert and his fellow students at Augusta Institute and Atlanta Baptist Seminary, the ancestors of Morehouse, were among the very first Americans of any race or any background to use what is today, I think, an iconic handbook that is, the Robert's Rules of Order are used widely throughout the country. And Gilbert was one of the first people to use that book. And it also explains, I think, why he was such a good public speaker, that from early on, he had a lot of practice in parliamentary debate and the rules of procedure. And that is connected with his use of Robert's Rules.
Now, you talk about George William Walker. Was he really like a mentor to John Gilbert's life?
Yes. So George Williams Walker, also a South Carolinian, is a really fascinating figure. He came from a very prominent family in the white Methodist denomination called the Methodist Episcopal Church South, or MECCS. That denomination, by the way, no longer exists independently today. It was absorbed into what is today the United Methodist Church. But George Williams Walker, he studied to be a minister. And he was ordained, but he had a real skill for languages. He loved to read Greek for fun. He loved English literature, especially Shakespeare. And in 1884, he became one of the very first professors of Payne Institute, just at the time when John Wesley Gilbert was becoming the school's first student. And these two men appear to have become close very, very quickly. I think Walker recognized that Gilbert had a gift for languages, that he had a drive for education. And for the next several decades, they would work very closely together, first as teacher and student, then as colleagues in Payne Institute and Payne College, basically until the time that Walker died in 1911. And Walker undertook his efforts at Payne in the face of a lot of opposition, even from his family. A story that I tell in the book is that Walker's mother said, "It's a noble work you are doing with this school, but I wish that some other mother's son were doing it." And can you imagine being a mother and telling that to your son? Walker's fiance said, "If you don't quit working at Payne, our engagement is over." And he said, "Okay, well, our engagement is over," and he continued to work at Payne. And not just John Wesley Gilbert, but without exception, every account I've read from a Payne graduate or an alumna or alumnus recalling Walker in later years is, without exception, praises him as a man who lived the highest standards of education and who believed in true equality for all people.
Now, how did he get to Greece? What was that story?
Ah, okay. These are great, Deidre. By the way, these are great questions. We are going systematically through the book.
Thank you.
I hope I'm not speaking too quickly or giving you too much or too little detail. So you let me know if I need more.
Just right.
Okay, terrific. So how John Wesley Gilbert was a student at Brown University from 1886 to 1888. And during that time, he formed a close tie with his Greek professor, a professor named Albert Harkness, who nobody has heard of Albert Harkness today, but in the 1870s, he was extremely famous as a Greek scholar. He was a leading academic in the U.S. And Albert Harkness was also a founding member of a new research institution in Athens, Greece. And it was called the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. And the American School had been founded in 1881 by basically a consortium of American Northeastern U.S. colleges and universities to send Americans to Greece where they could do research in classical languages, Greek literature, archaeology, and history. And so it was through Albert Harkness that John Wesley Gilbert first learned about the possibility of going to Greece. But in the 1880s, you know, Greece was a long, long way away from the United States. Nobody went there for tourism. If you think about Greece today, it's sun and sand and beaches in the summertime. There was no tourist industry. It was a long and difficult trip. And if Americans traveled to Europe, they typically went to Western Europe and to Italy, or they might go all the way to Egypt or to Constantinople, but they rarely stopped in Greece. It was not a common destination. And Gilbert must have talked with Albert Harkness at Brown, and they kept in touch when Gilbert returned to Augusta to take up his job at Payne Institute. But eventually, Harkness was able to find funding, a fellowship from Brown University that would enable John Wesley Gilbert to go to Greece and spend an academic year there as a member of the American School. And that's what Gilbert did in 1890 to 1891. And that made him the first African-American student of the American School, but also one of the first 50 Americans of any background any background or any ethnicity or any race, any gender, in fact, to go to Greece and to do professional scholarly work there.
I thought it was very interesting in how he described himself on the passport. Nose straight. Tell us about that. Was that telling us something about his identity?
That is a terrific question about his passport. And you'll have to excuse me. I'm going to sneeze for a moment. It's allergy season out here in California. So in the 1890s, when John Wesley Gilbert went to Greece, passports were still not required. And in fact, many travelers went without them. But the American School recommended to its students, I think, that they get passports because they were useful for a place that was off the beaten track, like Greece. And when Gilbert filled out his passport application in 1890, there were no photographs that went with the passports. That would come later. And instead, there was a series of boxes that asked the applicant to describe physical features, nose, eyes, skin color, hair, and so on. And in filling out those boxes, Gilbert was writing responses that reflected his own self-perception of who he was, but he also had to keep in mind the responses of a clerk off in Washington, D.C., who might have a racial response based upon what he listed in those boxes. And the one that drew my attention, particularly in the book, is there was a space that asked, that had a blank before a description of, I was born and my father is a blank citizen. And usually applicants either wrote a native or naturalized citizen. And it was, I think the question was intended to ask about citizenship status. But in that box, in his 1890 application, Gilbert wrote native white citizen. And I go into this question at some length in the book. Why did he write that? Did it reflect something new he had learned about his father, his biological father, in the years since he had been a child? because he had had two stepfathers. His mother had married twice, once during, when he was young, and once right before he went, right after he went to Brown. But that's the only time that this mention appears. And in his later later passport applications, Gilbert never mentions the race of his father. And by the time he dies, the legend has appeared that his parents are Gabriel and Sarah Gilbert, who had both been enslaved. But in fact, the name Gabriel we can identify as one of his uncles. So that doesn't seem to have been the actual name of his biological father, but a legend that appeared later in his life. So it's a very complex story about passports and identity, and what Gilbert expected that a clerk in Washington might read into his responses on this form.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, once he got to Greece, you talk about there were two accounts of his treatment regarding his race. Which one do you think would be the one to accurately describe his treatment?
I think the episode you were asking about is about 10 years after Gilbert was in Greece. George Williams Walker was speaking at a conference in the United States, a missionary conference. And in that speech, he mentions that Gilbert got to Athens and met prejudice and was not allowed to live in the American school building. But that Gilbert was not disappointed by this, and instead he went and lived with a Greek family and got a Greek grammar and learned the language. Now, that story is from 10 years after Gilbert's visit to Greece, and it's in a speech where Walker also misremembers the other aspects of Gilbert's time in Greece. So the question I raise in my book is, you know, how much can we... How accurate is this story, and how much can we look to contemporary evidence about his actual living situation in Athens? And against this later story by George Williams Walker, we have to put Gilbert's sponsorship by Albert Harkness, who was very eager to have a Brown student to be at the American School. We have to put the general leadership of the American School, which at this time was led by an older generation of men, some who had been very active in the abolition movement and others who had had Black students at their schools. And we also have to consider the position of Gilbert's professor, a man named Rufus Richardson from Dartmouth, College. And in his private letters, Rufus Richardson treats Gilbert just as the other three students who are there. And there's no indication either from Richardson's private correspondence or from a later account by one of Gilbert's classmates that any distinction was made about Gilbert. And I go into this in some detail in the story, but I think a plausible explanation is that Gilbert got to the American School early before it was open. And this happened to another student, to Andrew Fossum. And the caretaker said, "You can't stay here. You have to go away." And Gilbert found a room in Athens. And that's exactly what happened to Andrew Fossum. And I think that a likely explanation is that Walker may have misremembered something Gilbert wrote him in 1890 and then told the story in a different way at that conference in 1901, because the story of his being excluded from the American school building really doesn't stack up against the contemporary evidence we have for the school's leadership and the private documents, private letters that we have from the professor at that time.
What was John Gilbert's best find in Greece?
Ah, that's a wonderful question. So when people think about archaeology, they, and especially if they're not familiar with the world of scientific archaeology, they are likely to think of, you know, finds as treasure, right? Something gold, a marble statue, painted pottery. And in his work at the ancient Greek city of Eretria, Gilbert, in fact, did take part in the discovery of many such items. Part of the American school's work at Eretria was to excavate tombs that had gold jewelry and had fine pottery, and they found pieces of sculpture. But actually, his greatest find was not that at all, but it was a find that he made along with his white classmate, John Picard, was about the topography and the history of the ancient city of Eretria. Ancient authors, especially the ancient geographer, a geographer named Strabo, had suggested that Eretria had been moved, that the city had moved over time. But what Gilbert and Picard found through their careful study of the city walls and the other remains of the ancient city was that the city appears to have always been on the same site. In other words, the ancient geographer had gotten something wrong about the story. And they made that conclusion in 1891 after their survey, Gilbert and Picard did, and the Greek and Swiss excavations that have continued since the 1960s have shown that they were right in their essentials, that Eretria did not move locations during the historic period. And so it's in that sense, his greatest find is not an object, but it's a clearer understanding of the location of this ancient city of Eretria.
While in Greece, he had a major family event to occur. What does this tell us about the dedication of his family to his work?
Yes. Well, either just before he left for Greece or while he, in the fall, he learned that he was going to be a father for the second time. So at the time that John Wesley Gilbert left for Greece, he and his wife, Ola, already had a young daughter. She wasn't walking yet, I think. But he learned that they would have another child and that the child was due in the early spring of 1891. And in my book, I suggest that this is one of the reasons why he felt a bit of time pressure in Greece, because he knew that he had another child coming. He would need to support his growing family. He wanted to be back there, perhaps in time for the child's birth, and it meant that his possibility of spending, you know, 2 years in Athens, which at one point it was thought he might spend 2 years there instead of 1 year. That he'd have to get a lot of work done, done quickly, and I think that that helps to explain why he was so focused on his work while he was in Greece. Because this was the time of his life where we'd have to do scholarship and to work through the reading list he had been assigned for his graduate studies at Brown University, and he knew that when he finished that list and he got that master's degree from Brown, it would be a great achievement. It would open the way to higher pay, maybe to new job opportunities, and so the fact of his growing family, I think, pushed Gilbert to be even more focused and dedicated than he normally was. And he was a very, very dedicated and very focused individual when it came to education, as we can see going back all the way to his Freedman's Bank record.
Tell the audience about his publishing history.
Maybe the first thing I would tell the audience about Professor Gilbert's publishing history is that we do not have the entirety of what he published, because he certainly wrote articles and essays that were destroyed either when the archives of Payne College were burned in 1968, or some of the archives were burned, or that were published in African-American newspapers in Georgia that don't survive for us. And the crucial one is the Georgia Baptist, which was an Augusta-based newspaper. It was highly respected, but the issues for the 1880s have almost all perished, and the issues when he was in Greece have perished. So we don't have the entirety of what he wrote. But we do have a wide range of publication, starting with an essay he wrote at Brown on Shakespeare and the authorship of Shakespeare's plays, which shows his interest in English literature. We have letters he wrote from Greece that survive as quotations in other newspapers beyond Georgia. We have a report that he wrote that was published in the American Journal of Archaeology, which is a flagship journal of American archaeological study. And he was the first African-American author to be published in that scholarly journal. And then in the rest of his life, we have a large number and a very varied number of speeches and essays and articles about topics, everything from education to advocacy for civil rights in Georgia and the United States. And later he has we have things he wrote based on his experience as a missionary in the what was then the Belgian Congo. Around 1915, he was becoming interested in sociology and sociological questions of urban health and housing. So although we do not have everything he wrote, here was a scholar of classics who wrote about things Greek and mostly Greek, maybe a little bit less Roman, who was interested in English literature, who wrote about Shakespeare, who wrote about topics of the day and was an advocate for his community and for African Americans at a national level, and who wrote about his experiences as a missionary. So it's a fragmentary record, but it really shows him writing in many different areas of his endeavors.
Now, the mission work in Africa and the legend that he contracted sleep sickness. Tell us about that.
So after Gilbert passed away in 1923, the story went around that he had succumbed to sleeping sickness. And there are actually two different forms. There are two different types of sleeping sickness. I'm going to pronounce it trypanosomiasis. So the West African form can actually, it is possible, I did some research in medical journals, it's possible for people to be bitten by the fly, which carries this disease, and then to carry the disease for quite a long time before showing symptoms. And Gilbert's, the separation between the time Gilbert was in Africa in 1911, 1912, and the time that he began to be ill around 1919, that's at the very outside edge of what I was able to read about the time between exposure and falling ill. But this story was repeated by a number of people, including John Hope, who had been a student of Gilbert's and is famous as a Southern educational leader, the first Black president of Morehouse College. And Hope, as a young man, had known Gilbert, but they hadn't been close in later life. So Hope was one of the people who mentioned this story. But what I found in my book was another story, and a story that was not preserved in the tradition, was that John Wesley Gilbert and Ola had a car, and they loved to go driving, and they would drive in Georgia for relaxation, for recreation, to tour the countryside, and they got in a car accident. And the car accident was so bad that Ola had an arm amputated. She was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And I close my book by noting that Gilbert also seemed to have suffered some effects from this, because if you look at his handwriting in the surviving trustees' minutes of Payne College, you can see his handwriting begins to deteriorate. And it seems to indicate that he suffered some sort of after effect of that car crash, maybe a blow to the head, a traumatic brain injury. I'm not a physician, obviously, so I can't diagnose him, but it seems like something happened to him after that car crash, which was so terrible for his wife as well. And after that time, he had brief moments where he recovered, but then he went downhill. And by 1921, he was confined to bed and unable to speak. And he spent almost 2 years in that situation before he finally passed away. And so that is a less, I mean, I until my book, it was, I think, an unknown story. But I think that it's possible that sleeping sickness affected him. But I think we have to consider the car crash as a perhaps a more likely candidate for what afflicted him in his final years.
What message do you hope your reader will gain by reading this book?
What message do I hope my reader will gain from this book? That is a great question. I think the first thing is to appreciate the life of a man who lived in a time where he, as a boy, he was discounted. Nobody thought that this little boy deserved an education. Nobody thought that he should be anything more than a manual laborer or a cart driver or some other occupation. And in the face of racism and segregation and violence, which, by the way, increased as his life went on. I mean, the 1870s and 1880s were a period when Jim Crow had not set in. In the face of all these obstacles, here is a person who persisted, who had a drive for learning, a drive for education, that took him from these very humble beginnings and from the legacy of slavery into the pinnacle of American education. I mean, he was at Brown. He was at the American School. These were, you know, he was at the national edge of education and classical studies. And he wasn't just a scholar. I think beyond that, you know, he was deeply devoted to his community and to his church. And he was a humble person from the accounts we have, who had friends of all different social ranks and classes. And he believed deeply in service. And that shows in his work at Payne College, it shows in his missionary endeavors, his civil rights work, and so on. So if you look at his, you know, at Gilbert as an individual, I hope the lesson or the story that I hope readers will get from my book is just to be inspired by someone who faced these terrible challenges, who was constrained by the society around him, yet nonetheless achieved. And he also helped others to achieve. And I think it's a truly inspiring story in that regard. You know, at a wider level, I have said this in other venues, but Gilbert's story is in some respect not unusual, because he's part of this Civil War and post-Civil War generation. You mentioned the slogan "We Are Rising," right? Where Black people across the country, young and old, men and women, boys and girls, were striving for education, and his story is one particular example of that. We can see it in the story of historically Black colleges and universities. And I hope that readers will appreciate that this movement of Black education is really, it's one of the greatest generations, you might say, that our country has ever produced. And those who know the story of HBCUs already know about these achievements, but I think it deserves more wider recognition as an incredibly, it's an extraordinary and inspiring, as a truly moving achievement in the United States.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. What's the next project you'll be working on?
I'm staying involved with the community in Augusta, and so there are some projects I'd like to do there that involve looking further at the Freedmen's Bank records. And I mentioned at the start of our conversation that I'm also an ancient historian, so I have to get back to the Persian Empire, and I have some things to work on about the Persian Prince Cyrus and a work called The Anabasis of Xenophon, which, by the way, is a Greek text that Professor Gilbert taught every year. It was one of his standard texts, Xenophon. So those are, and I have many different interests. I think my next project is to spend more time with my family. This was 6 years of really, really hard work where I was working all weekend, and I have three young children. And so I want to put my wife and my family first above any other scholarly projects for a while.
Well, we enjoyed this project and we'd be looking forward to others. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Deirdre, for having me. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you.